This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Macro Voices episode 31 was recorded on September 15th, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. We're bringing back one of our most popular guests ever this week. Raoul Paul is the founder of Global Macro International and Real Vision Television, and an extremely well-respected macro analyst. Regular listeners know that Raoul always gives a great interview, but he really knocked it out of the park this week. We'll be discussing the U.S. dollar, treasury yields, precious metals, the business cycle, European exit contagion, systemic risk in the European banking system, sovereign credit risk, soft commodities, and much more. You're not going to want to miss this one, folks.
And I'm Aaron Chan. Last week, the S&P 500 had managed to go two whole weeks without breaking out to yet another new all-time high. But Eric, you were quick to observe that when we taped the show last Thursday afternoon, we were still within 10 points of the all-time high. And boy, did that change in a hurry. The market took a nosedive starting right after we taped last week's show in Thursday night's overnight futures session, and continued all day Friday and into the Sunday futures session, eventually testing 2100 even, fully 80 points lower than where the index stood when we taped last week's show. But then on Monday, it retraced more than half of the move, testing 2150, before rolling over again to the downside, again trading below 2110 earlier this week. But as we're taping today's show, E-mini S&P futures have rebounded and are trading at 2140 with a few minutes left in Thursday's trading session. Eric, what's going on with the sudden volatility in equities here?
Well, you said it, sudden volatility, and I think it's a lot of data scares. You know, the real question is, will she or won't she? Are we going to see a rate hike? The expectations have been up, down, backwards, and forwards, and I think nobody really knows what's going on. My take is I think the Fed has reached a point where they've realized that they probably can't hike rates, but it's such a loss of credibility to admit that their hiking cycle was going to be a cycle of only one hike. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, I think back to, you know, in August when everything was hunky-dory and we were breaking out to new highs every week, I made a comment, which was that a lot of people think that market crashes tend to happen in October. And if you look at the actual historical data, really the way it tends to play out is the high happens sometime in August, the top happens in August, then you get crazy volatility in September, and it's the final shebang that happens in October, and that's what everybody remembers. Well, boy, it's starting to play out that way. We saw a top in August, and if this isn't crazy volatility in September, I'm not sure what is. It doesn't mean that the market's going to crash in October, but I'm starting to get more and more concerned. Really, I think a lot of it has to do with rate hike expectations. I'm going to definitely be asking Raoul about this in today's feature interview as well.
Right. And last week, we reported an utterly massive 14.5 million barrel drawdown on nationwide crude oil inventories. And you even said that Tropical Storm Hermine shutting in production in the Gulf and delaying the arrival of tanker ships was the probable culprit. So how did we do on this week's inventory numbers, and what else is affecting the oil market this week?
Well, it was another soft inventory report. I guess I say soft in the sense that I'm looking forward to some big builds on inventory, which I think are coming. This was another 500,000 barrel, actually 560,000 barrel drawdown on national inventory, 1.25 million barrel drawdown in Cushing inventory, which is very critical in terms of what would affect the price of the WTI crude oil futures contract. Gasoline, on the other hand, and distillates, big builds, 570,000 barrel build on gasoline. It would normally be a very large build, of course, in the face of an utterly humongous one last week. It doesn't seem so big. 4.6 million barrel build in distillate inventories, though, was utterly massive. And production ticked up this week, breaking a three-week downtrend. So U.S. production is increasing. Obviously, the effects of Tropical Storm Hermine are still being felt. I think a lot of people, just watching the tape action, a lot of people thought that, you know, first they went crazy last week on the 14.5 million barrel draw. Then they figured out it was weather related and calmed down a little bit. A lot of them were expecting a massive build this week, as if just 1 week later, all of a sudden, the 14 million barrels was going to come back again or something. It doesn't work that way. You know, there were producing rigs in the Gulf that were shut in advance of the arrival of that storm. It takes a lot of time for this stuff to clear out of the system. Our friends at hashtag OOTT tweeted this week that they're predicting still 2 weeks out, you know, two more Wednesdays ahead of us, is when we're going to have the really, really big build on inventory. And that's based on their tanker tracking and the other work that they do to analyze flows of imports and movement of oil around the globe. To be honest, I haven't even gone into detail, and I can't tell you why they think it's still 2 weeks out, but we do have a link to hashtag OOT. You can, of course, just type in hashtag OOTT on Twitter, or if you want to find Sam Madani's homepage where his pinned tweet has all kinds of information, there's a link to that in your research roundup email. Art Berman this week had an excellent post about what he's calling a glut bomb, both IEA and EIA revising their estimates, saying that they think the oil glut is going to persist into 2017. It's not going to be resolved as quickly as they had previously thought. Meanwhile, Thursday morning, we saw both Nigeria and Libya news coming out suggesting that there will be increased production from both of those countries. That led to a big down spike. 43.26 was the low print. That was fairly quickly retraced. It's been a real roller coaster ride today on Thursday. All the way up to about 44.35 was the intraday high, and we're back down to a 43 handle, 43.82, as we're speaking just a little bit before the session close on Thursday afternoon. By the time this podcast is edited, it may have moved a dollar in either direction at the rate that things are going. In terms of the big picture here, my judgment is that the bearish factors outweigh the bullish factors. There are a lot of bullish factors, but they're short-term bullish factors, weather and so forth. And the bigger picture is more bearish. I think the market is waiting for confirmation. They want to see that big rebound in inventory to prove that it was just a one-off event when we had that really big drawdown last week. And again, the hashtag OOTT guys think that that big inventory build might still be 2 weeks away. So follow them on Twitter in order to find more on that one.
Right. And Eric, at this point, I've basically lost count of how many weeks in a row that I've announced yet again that we've been watching a technical consolidation range in gold between 1308 and 1377. So 2 weeks ago, it looked like we were right on the hairy edge of a breakdown below that key support level at 1308, and we even saw 1306 briefly on the intraday basis. And then last week, the market surprised us by trading as high as 1357. After that unexpected strength last week and Jeff Christian's bullish outlook, I thought maybe this week we'd be discussing a breakout above, say, 1377. But instead, we actually tested 1312 on Thursday morning, only a few dollars above key support at 1308. Eric, any visibility on when I am getting out of this broken record loop?
I don't know. We're still there, you know. Last week, I was actually a little surprised by how bullish Jeff Christian was. I was leaning towards more of a bearish view. I was starting to get persuaded of that, and sure enough, as we're speaking now, just before the close on Thursday, 1316 is where we're looking at right now, and as you say, 1312 was the low print this morning. So we're back to flirting with the bottom of that trading range. I definitely want to talk to Raul Paul in today's feature interview about this and get his take. I would not be tempted to buy here, even though we seem to, you know, if you listen to what Jeff Christian said, you know, look for a buying opportunity. Well, we're right at the key support level. That would seem to be a buying opportunity. And if you want to follow Jeff Christian's advice, it's time to buy here. I don't know that I would quite take that leap without hedging it. And the hedge, as I've talked about before, is a pairs trade, long the gold futures contract and long the dollar index at the same time. Those are normally inversely correlated, but as Raul and I discussed, there are some reasons why I think there's a possibility of a home run with both of them moving to the upside. Both moving to the downside at the same time, really hard for me to find a scenario where that could happen.
Yeah, looking forward to Raul's take on that trade. So 10-year Treasury yields jumped more than 10 bips higher this week, priced to yield about 1.71 on Thursday afternoon. So, Eric, any change on your outlook here?
Well, you know, I don't know if there's a change in my outlook, but a little bit of a change of course of action. I was waiting for 170 because I thought that was going to be a resistance level in yield, a support level in price, and I thought maybe that was the time to put on the trade that I have regretted not having on earlier this year, which is a long position in 10-year Treasury futures, not because I think that they're a smart long-term investment. Obviously, loaning money to an arguably insolvent borrower for 10 years unsecured at 1.5% interest is pretty darn crazy. But it's a trade for the sake of expecting lower yields still to come. I chickened out of that this week, and the reason is there are just so many really smart people, whether it be Jeff Gundlach, who's a very, very prominent hedge fund manager, Ray Dalio, even more prominent hedge fund manager, saying this week that the credit cycle is over. Jeff Gundlach had said that he thinks that the high in bond prices, low in bond yields is in, and that it's going to be, you know, heading higher from here in yield to 2% by the end of the year. Goldman Sachs had a research note out this week. We've got a link to that in your research roundup email, where they're presenting three arguments for why they think bonds will continue to sell off, yields will continue to move higher. I chickened out. I was going to buy the dip. I thought 170 would be a resistance level in yield, and we would roll over and eventually head back towards 1%. Definitely, I want to catch up with Raul Paul on this, because last time we spoke to Raul, he and I both thought that we were headed for 1%, or he thought even 0.5% on the 10-year yield. I'm very curious to find out whether or not Raul still has that view and what he makes of this. But for now, until I talk to Raul at least, I'm chickening out of buying the dip.
All right, makes sense. And last week, we were back down to a 94 handle on the dollar index, and I see it's recovered to a 95 handle this week. So what's going on with the dollar here?
95 spot 225 as we speak, just before Thursday's close. And yeah, you know, it's been up and down. I think as far as immediate tape action, we're kind of in a trading range, a consolidation range. I don't have anything particularly noteworthy to say about the tape this week. What I would say is it's really a question for me. I have expressed a bullish view about the U.S. dollar eventually resolving to the upside, moving above 100. And I think that there is a strong argument for the U.S. dollar rally to resume in earnest. But the thing is, if I look at the short to intermediate term, you know, what do I see on the radar macro-wise? I think we're getting closer and closer to the point where the Fed throws in the towel and finally admits that the economy is not strong enough for them to continue on this rate hiking cycle that they claim to be in, although it's actually been longer between rate hikes than any other cycle in recorded history. So it's hard to even say that we're in this cycle. But they haven't admitted that they're going to give up on trying to hike rates. If they were to give up on it, that really could send the dollar lower, at least on a temporary basis. I think maybe creating a buying opportunity. Again, the dollar is something that I have tremendous respect for Raul Paul's view on, so I'm going to be listening very closely to his take as we get into the future interview.
Not sure if we can get this trending, Eric, but hashtag ask Raul. Thanks for the market update, Eric. Real Vision Television co-founder and Global Macro International founder Raul Paul was one of our most popular interviews ever when we featured him back in April. So we're delighted to have him back with us as this week's featured interview guest. Eric's interview with Mr. Paul is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is one of our all-time most popular guests. Raul Paul is, of course, the founder of Real Vision Television and Global Macro International. Raul, thanks so much for joining us again on the program. We're really delighted to have you back. I want to start with the U.S. dollar rally. You and I both thought when we spoke back in April that the dollar was taking a pause but likely to resume its rally in earnest. And so far it's taking at least longer than I expected. Has your view changed at all? What do you see on the horizon for the dollar?
No, my view hasn't changed, but like you, I've noticed that it's taken longer than I expected too. It's been kind of coiling for some period of time. There's been virtually no volatility, which was, you know, true of many asset classes until maybe last week. You know, I still think that that the dollar is going to rise. We've seen some really interesting things happening in the LIBOR and euro dollar funding markets, which means that US interest rates have shot higher. And the interest rate differential between the US, for example, and Europe would suggest that something like the euro should go back down to parity. Obviously, it's not happening yet, but I still think the balance of probabilities lies with the fact that this is still a pause in the dollar rally and the dollar goes much higher over time. I think, as I think we talked about in the past, is I think in a situation where the global economy and the US economy slows, I think the dollar goes higher because US rates are still relatively high and there's more opportunities on a relative basis there. And I think that, you know, as rates get cut around the world, which I think they will do at some point, again, the interest rate differentials mean that if the US is bad, the rest of the world is worse. So the dollar goes higher. And this funding issue means it's actually very hard to get hold of dollars outside of the US. And that's creating a problem where we could see some real pressure on people who borrowed dollars and need to pay some of those back. So I'm really still focused on the dollar. You know, I'm getting a bit bored of the trade, waiting and waiting and waiting, but I think it comes.
I agree completely with everything that you just said, but I want to ask a follow-up question because I'm almost thinking that maybe we're in for, at least temporarily, another dip in the U.S. dollar index, simply because it looks to me like, you know, the macroeconomic data keeps getting worse. And I think eventually Janet Yellen is going to have to chicken out and basically admit that this rate hiking cycle didn't work, isn't working, and isn't really going to happen. And I think if the market concludes that there's no more rate hikes coming, at least in the short term, that would probably cause a pretty big downside move in the dollar index and probably a buying opportunity. Would you agree with that, or do you see it differently?
Yeah, I think that's possible. You know, I think people are confusing the dollar price action only with the fact that the Fed are hiking rates. I think it's a much more structural issue, as we've talked about again in the past, and I've talked about frequently, you know, the $10 trillion short position that's out there and the funding pressures that are there for those short positions as well mean that regardless of what happens to interest rates, the dollar goes higher. But I do think very much so that, you know, there is a risk that, you know, as the Fed start coming out of the equation, that the dollar weakens for a bit, goes back down to the bottom of the range. It's possible. I don't really know. You know, as it's been coiling like this, you usually get a break one way or the other. We may get a false break lower. So maybe in the DXY goes back down to the 92.5 level or so. But really, I think, you know, the larger move, you know, the next 10-point move is higher as opposed to lower in the DXY, so i.e. in the dollar.
I want to move on to another topic we talked about back in April, which is Treasury yields. At that time, yields were quite a bit higher, I think, than they are now, and you and I both thought that they were headed lower. I thought I was bold in predicting 1% on the U.S. 10-year before this is over, although I don't know that it would happen this year. You were even bolder than that, saying maybe 50 basis points before it's over. And that's kind of been the view that I've held on to. But boy, I'm starting to get a little bit intimidated. We've got some pretty big names like Jeff Gundlach declaring that interest rates have bottomed. The top is in for bonds. That's it. Ray Dalio commented just this week that the credit cycle is over. Do you think that these guys are onto something? Is it time for us to revisit our view? Or are you still hanging on to the view that Treasury yields will eventually move considerably lower than they are now?
Yeah, I mean, tactically, for my global macro investor clients, I closed out all of my bond positions, which I've had for 2 years now, the end of last month, thinking that there would be this backup in rates. It's very typical to have this kind of backup when the market gets overpositioned ahead of what I think is a recession still to come. And we've seen that in the economic data. So, you know, I've been looking for this stab higher. I don't know how much higher it goes. You know, could it get to 2%? Possible in the 10-year. However, I think that is sowing the seeds for strengthening of my recession case. And in which case, then I think bond yields do come much lower. And there's no reason to believe that in a recession that US 10-year bond yields wouldn't get down to 50 basis points. We've seen it absolutely everywhere else in the developed world. So there's no reason the US escapes it. you know, does it matter if it gets to 70 basis points, 100 basis points? No. I mean, the balance of risk rewards over time, you know, even if it backs up to 2% from here, that's, you know, 30 basis points with 100 basis points of downside, even in your case scenario. In my case scenario, it's, you know, it's 150 basis points. So the risk reward is very much in the long term setting up for a better trade being long bonds.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I had been watching 1.70 as, you know, what I, as high as I thought this bounce was going to go. I would have told you a week ago that if we saw 1.70, I would probably buy 10-year treasuries there. I chickened out after Goldman was out with a research note this week. We've got a link to that for our registered users in the research roundup email that came with this interview. You know, I think that, as you say, the bounce could go higher, but I agree with your long-term view for sure.
And also, you know, referring to the great and the good of the world saying the rate cycle's turned, we need to look at, okay, what are the things that turn the rate cycle? It has to be either inflation or credit risk. Neither of those look at this point in time to be an issue. So I don't see a reason for that to happen. And, you know, unfortunately, the great and the good got the JGB market wrong for the last 20 years. And I've seen them all, you know, every one of the most famous investors in the world get that market wrong. So, you know, it can happen. I think that they're unlikely to be right. I think, you know, the demographic tailwinds and all the other things that go with why the bonds are where they are, I think, are not going away.
I want to go back to another view of yours, which I think came after our last interview. You published a fantastic video on Real Vision Television about the business cycle, and I'll summarize it to say your view is, you know, the business cycle is pretty darn long in the tooth here, and probably, you know, it's time to start really seriously looking at recession risk. That was now several weeks or even a couple of months ago, I think, that you put the video out. How has your view evolved since then? What's the update on that view? What do you see coming?
Yeah, so I use the ISM survey in the US as my guide to the global business cycle. You know, there are differences elsewhere in the world, but what we saw is, you know, the business cycle had been ticking up after being particularly weak into the back end of last year. It had been ticking up as the ISM hit into the kind of, you know, 54-ish level, and then suddenly it dropped in 1 month below 50 again, which is suggesting that GDP growth is somewhere around 1%. The business cycle usually has finished around this period of time. This is the third longest business cycle in history. I think the probability is still that the cycle will continue to fall and play out to be a full recession, which would be the ISM going below 45. There's a lot of things that back that up. If we go through various sectors, whether it's the retail sector, whether it's restaurants, whether it's durable goods, whether it's freight, whether it's world trade, you know, most of these things are all in recession now. So there's very few areas of the US economy and the global economy that aren't in recession. So, you know, the likelihood is that the overall economy shifts towards a recession. So the other thing to bear in mind is that I went back and looked at every single presidential two-term presidential election, i.e. when the incumbent changes. There is a 100% track record of a recession within the next 12 months. It either starts just beforehand or starts afterwards, but within 12 months, we're 100% chance of recession.
Well, I want to follow up on that then, because last time we spoke about equities, I think you and I had about the same view, which is we were out of our long positions, but didn't dare to go short yet because, you know, we've just seen this market march higher and higher. In the last couple of months, we've just seen a rapidly growing chorus of incredibly famous people, whether it be George Soros, Ray Dalio just coming out this week saying the credit cycle is over, Carl Icahn saying that he is more hedged than he's ever been in his career. A lot of people are really, really saying that something nasty is about to happen in the stock market. Would you say it's time to be short now? Are you still waiting and watching? What do you think?
I made a decent mistake of shorting over that Brexit period and then saw everything bounce again. So I've got some short positions on and I'm kind of holding on to them because, you know, the relationship between the business cycle and the equity market says, again, the balance of probabilities are that they come lower. I could have got a better location on the trade. So I was really patient all year, kept out of the trade, kept out of the trade, kept out of the trade. Then I thought the Brexit thing really was a bigger deal, and I think it is a big deal over the long term. But I got it kind of wrong, so I am short now and just kind of holding on to the trade. I mean, the market's not going anywhere, really. Even though it drifted higher, you know, it's not significantly higher that's pressurizing me on the position, because, you know, my views tend to be of the longer-term view. But I do think it comes lower.
I want to pick up on the European exit contagion topic, since you mentioned it. When the Brexit vote first happened, you and Grant Williams both said, hey, this is likely to, in the long run, be remembered as sort of the first step in the collapse of the European Union, potentially. But you were also very careful to say that doesn't mean there's an imminent, it's all going to fall apart tomorrow. This would play out over a period of years. We haven't had a period of years yet, but we've had a period of several months. How is your view about European exit contagion developed since then? Do you still see it as a serious issue? Is it getting better? Is it getting worse? What do you think?
I think we can see from the political situation across Europe, whether it's what's happening with the German right, what's happening in Italy, and what's happening with the French right, is that there is a populist movement growing, and it's coming from discontent. And, you know, they blame on immigration, but there's a general discontent with the working population in America and many of the developed countries. And I think the chances of people looking for a different way out and pushing towards something with Europe is definitely a high chance. Which way is that? Is that the Germans forming their own, you know, bloc, or is it the weak countries getting ejected? You know, I just don't know. I mean, this is really beyond any of our predictive abilities, but we can say that the likelihood is for something bad. And so then we look for catalysts, and we know we've got the catalysts of these various elections around Europe, and we have to take them very seriously. So, you know, the Spanish have not been able to hold a government together now for 9 months. It looks like they're going to their third election, and I think they're going to fail to get government again. So Spain is basically ungovernable right now. Let's see what happens with the other European countries. But, you know, the US election is also part of the same situation, and Brexit was part of it too. So it makes it complicated. Brexit also shifted the odds of something else happening in Europe higher, because it showed that people can reject the status quo. And I think, you know, that again adds pressure in a country like Spain, where Catalonia is still pushing for something differently. Maybe the Basques will too. And maybe in the end, another country will. You know, maybe Greece decides, you know, it's had enough of the pain it's been forced to take. Maybe it does something. So, you know, it really isn't clear, but, you know, these are not inconsequential probabilities.
Something I've noticed just in the last week is a kind of unusual movement in that we're seeing both equities and bonds selling off at the same time. And of course, that breaks the usual theory that, you know, one is selling off and the money's going into the other one. One of the theories that's been posited out there by some of the bloggers is that risk parity funds are unwinding, and that's causing this. What do you make of this? Do you see it as significant?
Yeah, listen, you know, when there are overcrowded strategies, you create risk. And there's a lot of overcrowded strategies out there right now. Risk parity is one of them. So, you know, it'd have been a great trade to be long bonds and long equities. And so there is an issue if both sell off, you know, causes both positions to sell off. And that, you know, the amount of money in that strategy is very high. It's much higher than people think, because banks are also creating synthetic hedge fund or synthetic risk parity trades for underlying clients as well. So it's not just the funds that we know of. There's a lot more money indexed to these kind of strategies. So I think that is certainly an issue out there. You know, there's a lot of money in those kind of strategies. Can that cause some forced selling? Of course it can. I'm also very concerned about the amount of VIX selling that's gone on, the open interest in short positions in VIX futures. Is the highest in all recorded history. That's coming from yield enhancement trades by pension funds, who are trying to pick up any yield they can. And they think the smart way is to sell volatility. And I think obviously that's a pretty dangerous trade, because when volatility explodes, everyone's got a margin call, and actually they end up selling equity and doing all the things they didn't want to do, because they thought they were going to be a buyer of equities into a dip. But they end up, because of the amount of margin, end up having to sell equities. So I think that's problematic too. So I think there's some concentration of positions in various strategies that is not good. I also don't like the fact there's a lot of illiquidity out there, and a lot of people are in illiquid strategies. And I think that is something that can all feed on itself. That being said, you know, none of these are going to be meaningful unless the economic cycle is proven to be, you know, heading towards or in recession, in which case then bad things tend to happen. If it's not and the economic cycle is still, you know, lackluster but still relatively expanding, then the chance of this being a short scale event, which is what it looks like in the bond market right now, is more likely.
Well, you talk about a vicious cycle. If you have pension funds that are forced to sell equities in order to try to combat a runaway upside move in the VIX, that feeds on itself pretty darn quickly. Let's move on to a topic that I know is a favorite of yours and mine as well, which is gold. I was actually a little bit surprised. Jeff Christian, when he was on earlier this year, had a bearish view. We had him back on the program last week, and even Jeff is very bullish now on gold, sees it moving higher. But boy, this trading range we've seen post-Brexit between 1308 and 1377. 2 weeks ago, we were testing the low end of it with an intraday below 1308. Last week, 1357, and we're back to 1312 on Thursday morning. So what's going on with gold here?
Well, I actually took profits on my short-term gold positions at the beginning of September, as well as I did with my bond position, noting the correlation between bonds and gold. And my thesis for owning gold over this period was that negative rates meant that gold was becoming more and more attractive over time. There's the long-term story of gold and fiat currency. We all understand that one. But really, for me, the big driver was going to be the negative interest rates. And if I thought bond yields were going to back up, which they've done, I thought gold would come lower, which it's done. Now, I think both of those state of affairs are temporary. Can gold go a bit lower than here? Possibly, you know, or is this a tight wedge that it's forming and it breaks higher? That's probably true too. I'm actually long gold versus the dollar, and I'm also long gold versus a basket of global currencies. Two different ways of having that trade on. I was long gold versus the dollar in the normal gold way before, but that was the trade I took off. But I've still got the other two trades on.
That brings me to a trade that I've been considering very seriously, which is the pairs trade, long gold and long the dollar index at the same time. And of course, most people will tell you, well, that doesn't make sense. Those are opposite. But I think that we do have a backdrop forming where both could move higher at the same time. Or I could be wrong and one could go up and one the other could go down. So that's a perfect hedge. But boy, the scenario where both go down at the same time, I just can't find it. Am I missing anything? Can you see a scenario where they both go down?
No, I've had this trade on for 3 months or so now. It's one of my favorite trades in the world because of the risk reward, as you point out. I can't see them both falling. I can see them both correcting at the same time, but I can't see a trend where they both fall over time. So in which case, as you say, if we're wrong, you're going to have to volatility adjust the trade because gold is much more volatile than the DXY. I think it's probably half the amount of gold versus the DXY to give it kind of a rough volatility hedge, in which case then you can sit it out and you know, if they continue in the normal way that they do things, i.e., you know, gold falls when the dollar goes up, fine, we're all pretty safe. You know, you limit your losses pretty much so. But I think there's a chance of a home run over the next couple of years in that trade by holding on to the position. So, you know, I love these lopsided risk-reward trades. I think they make tremendous sense. And I think it's a great kind of trade that you don't put on too big a size, but you can just leave on and let it work over time. Don't use it as a trading position because there's a lot of noise in that kind of trade, but you keep it as a longer-term structural trade.
I couldn't agree more. Something that interested me this week was Goldman's note where they were listing reasons they think that the bond sell-off, the Treasury sell-off, is going to continue. And one of their views, one of the three reasons they cited in that piece that we sent a link to our subscribed users in this week's research roundup, was they think that European volatility, China and Japan and so forth, is all calming down, and that the flight capital that was coming out of China, Japan, and Europe into the United States is pretty much played out. Would you agree with that view? Particularly, we haven't talked about China and Japan yet in this interview. How do you see things going there, and what do you think it means in terms of the flight capital situation?
I think they're thinking about this in the wrong way. The reason the flight capital is subdued right now is because the dollar's subdued. If the dollar starts going higher, then suddenly the flight capital situation across all of Southeast Asia and emerging markets increases again. I've just come back from Hong Kong. I was there last week. Most people there are pretty bullish on the region. When pushed why they're bullish, they basically think that in the event of nothing happening, then emerging markets do okay. So that's the bullish thesis. And then when I question them about, well, what happens if the dollar goes up, they say all bets are off. So, you know, and I think that's the same with partly with treasuries, but there is no growth. I mean, the RSM is below 50. So you need to be very careful extrapolating growth and therefore a higher interest rate market. You know, if that were the case, the Fed would find it easier to raise rates. And I think they're finding it particularly difficult to look for any window of opportunity to raise rates because the economy is just too weak. So I don't really buy the Goldman argument that it goes on for any particular structural reason. Yes, if the dollar remains stable and the ISM remains around these levels, can bond yields drift higher a bit, as we talked about, up to 2%? You know, that's possible. Is it a more meaningful structural cyclical trade? No, it's the wrong part of the business cycle. Bond yields tend to go up when the business cycle has turned from a recession and going higher. We're just not at that point. We're looking for the opposite. So I don't think the balance of probabilities lies in favor of Goldman's view.
Speaking of monetary policy, what do you think is going on in terms of, it's been so many times now that, you know, trust us, really, we're about to hike rates. Next meeting, it's a live meeting, trust us, really, really, we're going to. It feels to me like maybe we've gotten to the point where the Fed has figured out that the economy just won't allow them to raise rates, but they have to keep saying they're going to because people would panic so much if they didn't. What's your take?
You know, I really have no idea what they're trying to do, and I hear a thousand different stories of what they're trying to do. I guess one thing is useful is to try and create a positively sloping yield curve, which I think is one of the things they're trying to do, because that stops the banks getting into a terrible mess. You know, we've seen once the yield curves start flattening, and the US yield curve flattened massively, that banks start getting into huge problems. So maybe that's their way of trying to keep the yield curve positive without people starting to, you know, panic about future growth and future inflation and therefore killing the banking sector again. Maybe that's their game. But at some point, the market's going to give up with that view. And again, for me, I step back and I tend to filter a lot of this noise out. A lot of people spend too long looking at the Fed. I look at the business cycle and understand what the Fed can and can't do. So if I look at the business cycle again, where it is, then the probability of them being able to do anything is pretty low. So therefore, it still makes me like bonds over time. So I think there's going to be a fantastic setup in the bond market soon, as we talked about, you know, to be long bonds, and everybody's out of the trade. It'll be a lovely, clear position. Economic weakness will be there, and the Fed won't raise rates. Even if they do raise rates, the yield curve will flatten like crazy. So I think, you know, I think the Fed is almost an irrelevance at this point.
And on the same topic of the Fed, something Jeff Christian brought up on last week's program was, you know, the situation with paying 50 basis points on excess bank reserves. There's plenty of reason to think that that could come under political pressure. It's essentially, the Fed is creating what, when you think about it, is really a financial disincentive for banks to loan money to hardworking American consumers. They're better off to just take the 50 basis points, keeping their excess reserves with the Fed. If they were to change that policy, which certainly you could easily imagine how there could be political pressure to do so in an election year, that potentially really changes everything. And Jeff thought it could be profoundly negative for equity markets if it happens. Any comment on that theory?
I don't think whatever they do, they can encourage the banking system to lend. And I think the Basel III regulations, the general banking regulations globally, mean it's much more difficult for banks to actually lend money in the manner they were before. Clearly, there's a lot of lending where the government has stepped in and forced lending, whether that's the auto sector or whether that's the some parts of the housing market and also the student loan market. So I don't think, even if you gave people money to borrow, that they would borrow. I don't think the banks are in a position to lend money, and they don't want to lend money, and the regulatory reasons stop them lending money. So I don't think there's any particular changes that will happen. I think everything has gone through a structural shift, and I think pretending the world was like it was in the past, where it's all pent-up borrowing, is probably not true.
I want to move on to a topic I know that you've done a lot of work on, Raul, which is the European banking system and the risks that exist there. You know, it seems like a lot of U.S. investors hear about Deutsche Bank and the potential message that we're getting from the European banking system, but nobody other than you seems to really be paying close attention. Give us the full backdrop on what's going on and what it means.
Yeah, I mean, I noticed this maybe 3 years ago that Deutsche Bank was looking concerning when people were telling us everything was okay. Deutsche Bank's share price didn't look good. The other one that didn't look good was Credit Suisse. UBS was somewhat similar, but that changed a little bit. Then it rolled into the Italian banks and back to the Spanish bank. I mean, nobody talks about the Spanish banks. And some of those, maybe 2 months ago, hit new all-time lows again. And yet nobody talks about a systemic problem in the Spanish banking system. But if I look back and just kind of think about what's going on, there is a big issue in the European banking system. Part of this is negative rates. Banks can't deal with negative rates. Secondly, it's regulation. They can't deal with regulation. Thirdly, it's bad loans, and they've got tons of them. So bad loans are still stacking up. There's still bad loans in Spain that have not been declared. The Italian banking system's completely straddled with bad loans. Deutsche Bank, on the other hand, has enormous derivative books. It's got positions that it can't get rid of. It's got an inability to it has problems with its collateral because it requires so much collateral for all the derivative stuff that's on its books. You know, it's creating distortions in the market. We're seeing some huge distortions going on in LIBOR right now. That was partly based on the money market funds, the shift in regulation putting money market funds into Fed funds. But this story of what's been going on with the tightness in the Eurodollar market, Eurodollar being Eurodollar interest rate market, has been going on for some time. And that's being driven from the European banks that are under tremendous funding pressure. And it's less and less easy for them to get money. And this is why some of the swap lines have been, well, they were tapped actually in Japan recently. The Europeans haven't tapped the swap lines, but the swap lines are in place with the Fed to try and supply dollars to the offshore market, the Eurodollar market, because it's really, really tight right now. And what I have noticed is as LIBOR, 3 month LIBOR, 1 year LIBOR keeps moving higher and higher and higher every day right now, it has been highly correlated to firms like Deutsche Bank. Because obviously the lower credit banks, lower credit quality banks, or ones where there's a risk perceived to be in the system, find it harder and harder to borrow money. Now, does this end up in a full-blown kind of banking crisis again? I don't really know. But what I do know is it's unsustainable for the Italian banks and the Spanish banks particularly to continue falling as fast as they have. And Deutsche Bank is something that's complicated. There's rumors swirling almost every day now that the Deutsche Bank are going to get some sort of bailout, whether they get whether the state take them over, something will have to happen. But the problem is why I'm really interested in them is how the ECB or the states, the individual states, deal with a bailout of a bank. Because they claimed in the Cyprus situation that bail-ins was the way that things were going to get done, i.e. that depositors lost their money. I'd love to see the Germans try and take depositor money away from Deutsche Bank. I don't think they'll allow it. And I think this ties well into that story of Europe. Is how are you going to hold Europe together if suddenly what was told to one country isn't applied to another, and particularly if that country is Germany? So I think, it's a really complex situation. I think it's a very interesting situation, and we need to be very aware of what's going on because at any point it could get ugly. Now, again, going back to my key theme and how I look at the business cycle, bad things happen in recessions. So if we are heading towards recession, the European economy is weakening. France is basically at recession point. Italy's in recession and Germany's now weakening. Spain's still looking okay. But if we start to weaken significantly, then the probability explodes of a bad thing happening. And the bad thing happening in Europe is twofold. One is the banks and one is the political situation. So that's why I think people just should not lose focus on this because it is a really big deal.
That brings to mind a follow-up question, because something I think a lot about, and I've only really researched it relative to the U.S. banking system, is netting of derivative exposure risk. And I know you're familiar with that, but let me just explain for our listeners' benefit. When banks evaluate their risk, they tend to net their exposure. So if they're short 1,000 or a zillion and one contracts of whatever it is, and they're also at the same time long the same number of contracts of the same thing with a different counterparty, they net it all together and they say, well, we're almost flat. We don't really have any risk. What that ignores is that if you're talking about over-the-counter derivatives where you have a number of different discrete counterparties involved, if one of those counterparties fails and defaults on their obligations under that over-the-counter derivative contract because they're bankrupt, all of the sudden everything else in the whole system is completely out of kilter because everyone else now, what they thought was a net flat exposure is actually a massively leveraged naked exposure that isn't hedged the way they thought it was. And they don't always account for this risk the way they should. When I listen to you talking about the European banking system, I'm just thinking, boy, what if one country really gets into trouble? Where does that leave all the other banks in Europe in terms of their derivative exposure to whoever is failing?
There's a much bigger risk than all of that. I spent a long time looking into, and I've talked about this on Real Vision before, I spent a long time looking into the clearing and custody system and the two systems, basically the DTCC in America and Euroclear in Europe. Those government bonds that are the heart of the derivative industry, they're the collateral for everything in the entire loan industry, those things are relent out something like 30 times within the system to allow for this leverage. The problem is nobody actually has the full claim on those bonds within the system and custody system. So if one of the countries in Europe defaults or something happens where it's, you know, let's say Santander goes bust and Spain goes bust on the same day, the systemic problems within the custody system, the derivative industry, all the collateral, the settlements is beyond anybody's imagination. The system cannot allow there to be sovereign risk, because if there is sovereign risk, then there's no risk-free collateral. And that is a real, real issue. And that would break the entire global banking system in one day, which is one of the reasons why they were so careful back in 2012 not to let anybody technically default, because had they have done that, basically it takes down everything that we know of as a banking system. And we would have to reprice what we understand to be the risk-free rate. We wouldn't have a risk-free rate. There's a really complicated thing within that. So yeah, it's a big problem if one of the banks goes under, particularly somebody like Deutsche Bank, that's the other side of a lot of derivative transactions for the rest of the street. But also if something else happened in Italy or Spain where the sovereign credit is taken into question, then we got a real big problem.
So what you're saying, Raul, you know, I think our listeners are all familiar with the concept of too big to fail. They had to save AIG because the whole system would have fallen apart if the counterparty risk had exploded. You're saying that really Europe has a problem that every single country in the union is too big to fail. If any one country has a sovereign debt crisis that just, you know, really goes nonlinear, the whole European Union falls apart because the counterparty risk is so great in terms of everybody holding everybody else's sovereign debt exposure. Is that right?
Yeah, sovereign debt exposure and banking exposure. You know, there's a big problem. So let's say it's Spain. Well, the problem is the Spanish pension system is now 90% in Spanish government bonds. So you kind of, the whole country starts falling apart if this happens. And the knock-on effects, as you say, I mean, yes, there's not huge amounts of leverage on Spanish government bonds, but there's a huge amount of bank leverage that has Spanish government bonds underneath it, and that may be Santander, and Santander is very active in the swap and derivative markets. So, you know, suddenly Santander's position doesn't have the collateral that it had, or it can't fund itself within the capital market. So, yeah, it really is a huge problem should that happen.
Wow. I want to move on to another topic I know that you follow a lot, which is soft commodities. You know, I think a year ago everybody was talking about the grains and they just can't sell off any more than they already have because they're just so low and they keep going. What's going on with the soft commodity market?
Yeah, so soft commodities are getting interesting to me again. Now, they got hit by the stronger dollar, as you'd imagine. But they can break from the stronger dollar because these are really supply and demand driven stories and they're much less macro stories. There is a big macro backdrop in grains, which is as the world moves towards higher protein diet, it uses a higher consumption of grain. As people go to higher calorific diet, you consume more of this stuff. Okay, that's all well and good. But what we had a perfect setup where we had fantastic few harvests in the US. We had decent harvests around in the southern hemisphere. Then we had an interesting situation where we had a El Nino last year. The El Nino meant that the US had a great crop. That's collapsed grain prices. Grain prices generally trade, or soft commodity prices generally trade on the US crop. However, in Brazil and Argentina and some other countries, the crops didn't do so well. So they had a shortfall. You know, Brazil's been a net importer of some commodities now, soft commodities now. So what it's done is shifted the stocks to use ratio globally and brought it down. Okay, that's all well and good. And, you know, the US crop has been bumper crop. You know, the harvest is coming out now. Prices are falling to reflect that. But I'm more interested in what happens next year. And is there a trade to be set up? Should we be focused again on soft commodities from the long side? And what I do note is that there is a relatively high chance that the El Nino turns to a La Nina. And the La Nina is the opposite weather pattern to the El Nino. And so just to simplify it, it tends to mean a dry season for the US. Now, obviously, California has had a tremendous drought. The El Nino barely did anything for it. It is the fruit and veg basket of the US. There's problems that will come from that. The aquifers are already low. Aquifers low in California are also the same aquifers that feed some of the grain states. So that's problematic in itself. But also it means many of the grain-growing areas will be dry. So suddenly you get a situation where there's been an abundance. The southern hemisphere suddenly drew down on that abundance. And then it's a potential for the US to also struggle. The La Nina tends to also play havoc with the southern hemisphere crops, bizarrely enough. We tend to get flooding in many places as well. There tends to be higher rainfalls in the southern hemisphere where the crop growing areas are, and it can create problems. So we're setting up to a position where suddenly we go from the embarrassment of riches to a shortfall. And I think, you know, that is possible to come out of, you know, corn, soybeans and wheat. And, you know, if those turn, they tend to go up, you know, 100% plus. So there's usually a really good opportunity when it happens and when it starts to turn. We haven't seen that turn yet. But one thing that interests me from a macro standpoint is that soft commodities in inflation-adjusted terms are the cheapest they've ever been in history. So food is just basically too cheap versus everything else. And considering the secular backdrop of the move to proteins, we know that the volatility risks remain to the upside. And yes, I understand the prices have been falling over time, but grains, I think, will get more volatile with much higher price spikes higher as people scramble in short supply times for the right amount of foodstuffs. So I think we're setting up in a position where something could happen with the weather. It could create a huge opportunity in some of these markets. Clearly, the positioning is going to be hugely short after the falls we've seen in most of these. And that makes it a very, very good opportunity to make some money out of this.
I couldn't agree more with everything you've said, but I also feel compelled to point out you've just made an excellent cyclical and weather-related argument that says maybe it's not quite time yet, but what's coming up is a long trade in soft commodities. But earlier in this interview, you also made a very excellent argument that the business cycle is way long in the tooth. We ought to be headed into a recession cycle next, and of course, you know, normally that would be bearish for commodities. How do you reconcile those?
Well, I think the way to reconcile it is you can be short industrial commodities and long soft commodities because they, you know, that spread does change, much like we'd rather be long gold than we would be long industrial. So there's a whole trade there. You know, people like to construct a long short, you know, less volatile trade. Well, I think you could be short industrials, and that would include oil and copper. I think you could be long precious metals, gold and silver, and I think you can start to look at being long soft commodities. And that whole trade actually sets up as a really nice kind of portfolio of more balanced risks, so you're not just trading the dollar going up and down, which can be the case in commodities. And soft commodities don't necessarily fall in recessions. They fell terribly in 2008 because of farmer funding. As the funding markets dried up, it became very complicated for farmers. So that and also margin calls and futures positions and all sorts of issues came out. But, you know, this time around, you know, we haven't had a bull market going into recession. We've had a bear market going into recession. So maybe there's the opportunity of the reverse of what we've seen.
Okay. I want to move on finally to a topic that I know is a favorite of yours as much as it is, or perhaps even more so than a favorite of mine, which is Real Vision Television. I think all of our listeners know that we are huge fans. We're also delighted to be able to offer Macro Voices subscribers a discount of 10% if they want to subscribe to Real Vision, which of course is a paid video on demand service for professional finance. But, you know, if there was one thing that I ever could have criticized about Real Vision, something I've learned in the podcast business is you've got to be able to provide people with the ability to subscribe on their mobile device through iTunes so it gets automatically delivered every week. If people had to go to macrovoices.com to get the podcast every week, they wouldn't remember to do it. There's such an advantage to having it automatically delivered. You guys didn't have that, but I think recently you've just introduced an iOS app. So what does it do and how does it improve the Real Vision service?
Yeah, we did. We in fact released a whole load of technological things, because one of the things we do is, as much like with your podcast, is when you spend time digging into people's minds and, you know, getting a much more in-depth look at how they think, you take a lot of time up, and you're then asking a lot of somebody's day. You know, to sit down to Macro Voices or to sit down to a Real Vision interview, you're going to need, you know, 45 minutes, an hour of somebody's time. And even if they'd love to do it, sometimes people don't have that time. So what we did is we did a number of things. Firstly, we now provide transcripts so people can just download the written version. So a lot of people like to write, to read written word because they can skim it faster than they can listen to an interview. So we did that. We also have the ability to listen to audio downloads of the actual things. And I know you guys have broadcast some of our audio downloads as well. But then we decided, well, the app was the real way, because people's time to consume this kind of stuff is in the gym, on the way to work, on a plane, on a train. And so the new app allows people to listen offline or watch offline these fantastic interviews. So basically you can watch these things whenever you want, wherever you want. And that's made it very, very accessible. And people have, you know, raved about it because it's just opened up a whole new world for them in the way they consume Real Vision.
I think you've also introduced a feature where those people who wanted to skim and go a little faster than the interview, can't you speed up the interview in the new application as well so you can listen to the faster version of it?
Yeah, exactly. You know, you can listen at 1.5 times speed or 2 times speed, just to give people a chance to get through an hour-long interview in an hour, because, to the human ear, it's easy to understand something at twice the speed, and, you know, it takes you a couple of times to get used to it, but you can digest information a lot faster. So we've just tried to make it really easy to consume, you know, some of the world's best financial content, because we understand it's a time commitment, but we know the quality is there and people just need to be given the opportunity to get through as much of this content as they can, because they learn so much from it that it is really valuable.
Well, it is an absolutely fantastic service. There have been rumors floating around the world of financial broadcasting that there might be even more coming from you guys. Anything you're at liberty to talk about as far as what might be on the horizon?
Nothing that I can disclose yet, but put it this way, we're launching 5 or 6 new businesses over the next 18 months. We raised some external capital from some rather famous folks that I'm sure your listeners will know, who are very keen on what we're doing with Real Vision. They love the fact that we're bringing kind of truth back to finance and some integrity and honesty back to the financial markets, much like you're doing with your own podcast. And so we've got about 5 or 6 different businesses launched. The first one will come out probably in October, maybe November. There's always technology delays in these things. But most of these things are going to be hugely disruptive as Real Vision was to the video industry, to the kind of financial video industry or financial media. We're doing things elsewhere as well that are going to be, I think, very interesting to people. And hopefully we can continue our revolution.
Well, I will look forward to telling our listeners about those when the news becomes public. And in the meantime, you know, as I've always said, we are extremely proud of the work we do here at Macro Voices. But if there's one place where you can get even better content than what we do, buy a Real Vision subscription, because you guys have you know, the benefit of full color video, and you also are able to attract higher profile guests than we've been able to get on the program thus far. So it's the only financial journalism source that I think exists that I just have to throw in the towel and say, yep, those guys are better than we are, but they're the only ones. So my hat is really off to you.
Thank you so much. I mean, it's really kind of you. I mean, we're big fans of what you're doing as well. You know, we're all very aligned with what we're trying to achieve. I tell you, we're talking about soft commodities and we're talking about fantastic content. I'm not sure when this is going to be released, but on Friday, this Friday, so that's the 16th of September, there's an incredible interview you will never get anywhere else. And that is Dan Tapiero, who is a macro investing legend and a good friend of mine. He worked for Julian Robertson at Tiger, Stan Druckenmiller at Duquesne, Michael Steinhardt, and Stevie Cohen. So Dan is one of the world's great macro guys, worked with all the greats. He's interviewing his friend, Dwight Anderson. Dwight is the head of commodity trading at Tiger, and also had the largest commodity hedge fund in the world. So he's another legend. And those two together are chatting about commodities. So soft commodities comes up in that interview, and I think people love it. I mean, you just don't get this content anywhere.
Well, and to be sure, if anyone is new and hasn't done it yet, you definitely want to go to realvisiontv.com/discount/macrovoices. If you haven't already had your free trial, you can get a 1 week free trial of Real Vision, and you can also use the Macro Voices discount code if you want to subscribe to get a 10% off on the actual subscription. And it is one of very few things that I don't hesitate to pay for and recommend to others. So I can't recommend it highly enough. Anything else you want to add before we close?
I think that's it. I think we've covered an enormous amount of ground, and I look forward to hearing the feedback. You can also find me on Twitter at Raoul, R-A-O-U-L-G-M-I.
Okay. Well, we'll certainly encourage our listeners to follow you on Twitter and definitely check out Real Vision Television, folks, if you haven't done so yet. Aaron Chan and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Wow, that was a great interview, Eric. And, you know, I've had this interview circled on the calendar for some time now, and I really grab at any chance to listen to Raoul share his concise and thorough takes on global macro and investing. So it was great to have him back on the program. And as usual, when I listen to Raoul, I'm left with some questions I haven't thought of before. So let's get right into it. Now, you and Raoul went on this tour d'horizon of global macro topics, but I want to start with Raoul's response to the Fed's near or medium-term impact on the dollar. Now, he said, quote, "The Fed is almost an irrelevance at this point." And I happen to believe in this view as well, because they've basically backed themselves into a corner, right? Walking a tightrope, or whatever metaphor you'd like, with depression on the one end and hyperinflation on the other, all the while the structural integrity of the rope upon which they are balanced is fraying with each additional economic or political catalyst. But it appears the market's reaction function to Fed speak still remains strong. But what sort of signs would you look for to see the market pricing in irrelevance? I mean, would it be something akin to the yen rallying when NERP was introduced in Japan? I mean, do you agree with this view? And if so, what are you looking for specifically?
Wow, that's a tough one. First of all, do I agree with the view overall? I have a really tough time deciding because I want to. I want very much to. I think that it's very well reasoned. And I think that, you know, Raoul's not the only one. There's a lot of really, really smart, famous people that are saying, okay, folks, we are at the end of the game here. Ray Dalio was just out this week saying it's end game time for this credit cycle, folks. You know, it can't go any further. So I really respect these people. The thing is, I have been wrong so many times since 2009. I made, frankly, this same argument several years too early, saying that QE1 was an act of desperation, that the Fed was going to lose credibility, that markets would see through all of this and recognize that they're not solving anything by papering over our problems and extending and pretending. I said in the summer of 2009 that by Christmas time of 2009, the market will have seen through it. Well, it's 6 years later, and I was dead wrong about that. So I tend to think in terms of what would actually tie their hands, because let's suppose that, you know, things start falling apart here and equity prices start to tank. What would stop the Fed from doing what they've done every other time, which is to conjure a few trillion more dollars in another major round of quantitative easing out of thin air and use it to prop up financial markets? Well, as we've discussed several times in the past, if you had runaway inflation, that would tie their hands. Another thing that would tie their hands, and I think that it may be that what we're seeing affecting equity markets is actually the presidential poll numbers. If Donald Trump were elected president, he's been fairly outspoken critic of this Fed policy. I think he might put political pressure on the Fed to stop propping up markets, and the market could totally tank in that case. And maybe, as you know, Hillary's fainting episode caused Trump to surge in the polls, that kind of coincides with this big dip that we took in equity prices. But aside from something tying their hands, I kind of go back to every time I thought they were going to lose credibility and the market was going to wise up and see what I think has been obvious since 2009, which is that these are acts of desperation that don't solve anything. They conjure a few trillion bucks out of thin air and they succeed at propping markets up. Now, as far as what the signal would be, if they do provide accommodation and it doesn't work, market prices fall off a cliff anyway, even in the face of an announcement of another round of QE. That would be the really big signal. You know, I don't know if it's happening. The way I've looked at it is I'm so tempted to be short equities here. I think we are seeing, you know, what could be a dead cat bounce. The timing is about right, as I said, for this to be the volatility bout in September before the really bad fireworks start in October. But, you know, I've felt this way so many times since 2009. Every time the market really starts moving to the downside, the Fed comes in and saves the day with more printed money. And what would stop them from doing it this time? So that's the conundrum in my mind.
So I guess you'll know it when you see it. While we're still on the Fed, we had a listener ask whether QE is technically money printing. And Eric, I think I know what you're going to say here, but for the sake of our listeners, why don't you clarify this once and for all?
Well, I think it's really just arguing semantics. Did Bill Clinton lie when he said that he had never violated the drug laws of the United States? Well, he didn't lie because he was in another country when he was violating their drug laws. You know what? It is a true statement that quantitative easing is not money printing in the most literal sense of there are no printing presses creating more dollar bills. What is happening with quantitative easing is the Fed is conjuring new money supply out of thin air that didn't exist before, and they're using it to buy treasury bonds. Now, another related question is quantitative easing effectively monetization of debt? Well, in a form of truth that only Bill Clinton could compete with, it's not monetization of debt simply because they're not buying those new treasury bills directly from the government. They're going through a middleman, which is one of the primary dealers, and that technically means, just as Bill Clinton didn't technically violate the drug laws of the United States, that it's not debt monetization. But what it really is creating new money out of thin air. Whether you call it money printing or not, I think it's a metaphor. I don't think it's really that important of a distinction, honestly.
Okay, thanks for clearing that up. Moving along, one of the great things about Raul is that not only does he give you the analysis, but he also speaks to how you might trade on this analysis, and I'm specifically referring to the gold-dollar pairs trade that you guys discussed. So gold hedges against NERP and inflation, while the dollar hedges against deflation and global deleveraging. And I think it was Grant Williams who said that the fact that this is a great trade in the first place tells you all you need to know about where we stand in the endgame. However, I recently heard Jim Rickards speak about a paper authored by Professor Marvin Goodfriend of Carnegie Mellon University that was presented at the Jackson Hole Central Bank in what I call summer camp, basically, a couple weeks ago, and it basically proposed an exchange rate between bank deposits and physical cash, or essentially placing a premium on cash deposited in the bank while penalizing those who hold physical notes. Now, we can probably agree that this is nothing more than a proposal to further NERP, but say something like this were to become official monetary policy, and given the long-term nature or horizon of this Paris trade, Eric, could you envision a scenario where, say, there's a limitation on gold holdings, and let's call it they impose a dual value on cash? I mean, where is this trade? I mean, could you see it backfiring to the downside?
I think the key to this, Aaron, is Raoul's comment that this trade has a lot of noise in it. I love this idea. I love it when I discussed it with Grant Williams several shows ago. I love it when I talk about it with Raoul this week. But hey, I loved it last week. Now, the dollar index and gold are both considerably lower than they are, particularly gold, than last week. And so as Raoul said, you've got to be willing to ride some volatility. And I think particularly you want to consider that if we were to break below that 1308 key support level, you could see gold take a bit of a nosedive down to, say, 1250 to 1280 or so. And particularly if we do see some reversal from the Fed at some point where they acknowledge that they're not going to be able to hike rates any further than they have with really just one hike in their so-called rate hiking cycle, that could cause the opposite reaction where the dollar tanks at that point. Gold should see some significant upside out of that. So those are two scenarios where both assets could see significant downside. It probably wouldn't happen at the same time. Now, it's tempting to say, oh, well, gee, that's really great. I'll leg into this trade by first waiting for gold to take a dip. I'll buy the long side of the gold trade. Then I'll wait for, you know, Janet to fess up that she can't hike rates. And when the dollar takes a dip, I'll buy that side and I'll have the perfect entry. Usually when you try to leg into a pairs trade, you outsmart yourself and end up getting screwed. So you got to pick a point to go long both assets at the same time. This week looks better than last week, but what if next week, you know, looks still better and you're down on the trade if you go into it? So as Raoul said, I think you've got to be ready to put that trade on small enough in size that you can ride out some volatility. But from a structural argument standpoint, can I think of a reason why a trend would begin where both dollar index and gold consistently move lower over time? No, I can't see it. I can see one or the other going down, and I can see why they might both go up, but I can't see them both going down over a sustained period, and that's why I love the idea of this trade.
Speaking of being screwed, I thought your conversation with Raoul about the European banking sector was fascinating. And I remember reading a Bloomberg article about, I think, a month ago, reporting on how Citi plans to purchase a $380 billion portfolio of credit default swaps from Credit Suisse. And this is after having purchased $250 billion from Deutsche Bank last year, with the intention of netting out their own derivatives book and lowering their derivatives exposure. It's been reported that Deutsche Bank sits on a derivatives book somewhere close to $75 trillion. Yes, trillion. And last month, Ben Steele and Emma Smith from the Council on Foreign Relations published a piece highlighting the doom loop of national banking systems in Europe being increasingly exposed to the debt of their governments as a percentage of total assets. I mean, Eric, it seems like there's no way out for them here.
Yeah, I think you're right. And as much as it would be nice to think that Credit Suisse is being responsible and reducing their risk exposure by offloading some of this stuff, maybe they're giving Citi a bargain price to offload all this potentially toxic and risky counterparty exposure, I think that might be giving him too much credit. I don't think that they're being responsible and diligent. I think they're probably responding to doing what they have to do. The banking system in Europe, as Raoul described, is in big trouble, and I think they should be reducing their exposure, but I don't have any hope that they're going to do some active diligence that makes everything better again, and all of a sudden the system is safe. I think we've got pretty serious problems, and I don't really see a clean way out to it.
Yeah, it's interesting that we're talking about this actually on the 8th year anniversary of Lehman going bankrupt. So last question, Eric. We recently had Art Berman on the program where he described his moonshot thesis for oil prices once the supply glut is worked through and the supply destruction finally kicks in. Now, having heard that, and now considering what Raoul is saying about a possible moonshot in soft commodities, I mean, it sounds like it could be a double whammy for consumers going forward. And I mean, this is without even factoring a decided downturn in the business cycle and hence a recession. So, Eric, how are you thinking about these different hypotheses in parallel?
Well, I don't really think about them in parallel because they're two different fundamental arguments. Raoul is talking about a commodity cycle event that's mostly about weather, the El Nino cycle reversing into a La Nina and changing weather, and that basically creating a bullish argument for soft commodities in the future. Art makes a very persuasive case about a moonshot coming in oil prices, but it has nothing to do with El Nino and La Nina. It has to do with when we eventually work through this supply glut, all of the supply destruction that has occurred as a result of this price sell-off is eventually going to catch up with us. Those are two totally totally different things, and I think that these two moonshots in prices would not likely happen at the same time. If they did, it would be pure coincidence. And again, as you said, you've got to look at the recession cycle also. Business cycle appears to be rolling over, and you know that potentially will prolong the oil situation longer than the same recession effect would prolong a more weather-oriented analysis that Raul is providing for soft commodities. So I think they're really two separate cans of worms, so to speak.
All right, makes sense. And unfortunately, we're out of time, but Eric, anything else before we wrap up the show?
Well, our regular listeners know the usual broken record here. If you want us folks to continue to bring you really fantastic interviews like this week with Raul, we need your help promoting the show. And we're right on the hairy edge of starting to gain traction to where we can get some bigger names on the show. I know you just finalized one really big name that we have coming up next month. We need your help. So please retweet us, sign up, particularly register your free account at macrovoices.com. Your benefit from that is the free research roundup email. If you don't want it, it takes one click to opt out of it. Aaron, let's tell everybody what they can expect this week.
Right, Eric. The Delivering Alpha conference was held earlier this week, and it hosted many big-name investors presenting their thoughts on global markets, monetary policy, and investment ideas. And for that, we've got full audio interviews from Jim Chanos and Paul Singer. We've also got a hold of the large slide deck from Jeffrey Gundluck's most recent investor webcast for Double Line clients. It's chock full of great charts, and you'll definitely want to check it out. Finally, on monetary policy, I'm sure many of you have heard of, or at least read, Ken Rogoff's pro-cash ban piece. Well, this week we're happy to bring you James Grant's teardown of that proposal in his Wall Street Journal article. You'll find all this and much more in the latest Research Roundup newsletter. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we've gotten and continue to welcome your suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For our listeners who write or blog about global markets and would like to share that content with our pro-finance community, shoot us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag, and we'll include it in our weekly distribution. If you haven't already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for the latest updates and interview releases. You can also follow Eric at Eric S. Townsend and myself at _AaronChen_. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chen. Chat with you next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at www.macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week, which never includes advertising or marketing. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we're able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can also subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.